Changing hands. Chapter 9. The director of the Florida Gaming Commission was Eddie Naylor, a former state senator who had happily surrendered his seat for the fat salary the new agency offered when casino gambling arrived in the early 1990s, and the state felt compelled to try and regulate it. His office was 3 blocks from Lacey's, and the meeting had been easy to arrange. Far from the grungy digs of the Board on Judicial Conduct, his suite was in a modern building with fine furnishings, a bustling staff, and apparently no budget constraints. Florida was happily in the gambling business, and its pliant taxing schemes were working smoothly. One look at Lacey, and Naylor decided he should leave his large desk and chat around the coffee table. At least twice before the coffee arrived, she caught him glancing at her legs, which were on full display courtesy of a skirt that was almost too short. After some preliminaries, she said, "Obviously, our office investigates complaints against non-federal judges in the state. There are a lot of them, and they keep us busy. Our investigations are confidential, so I ask for your cooperation in that regard."
"Certainly," Naylor said.
Nothing about the guy inspired trust, from his shifty eyes and greasy smile to his ill-fitting suit and dress shirt straining at the buttons. Probably has a generous expense account, she thought. He could easily pass for another lobbyist working the streets of Tallahassee. To impress her, he went through a windy summary of duties of his commission. All gambling in the state had been herded into one oversight agency, and he was the man in charge. Horse racing, dog racing, lottery, slots, casinos, cruise ships, even high-lie were now under his jurisdiction. It seemed to be a mammoth undertaking, but he was up to the task. "How much oversight do you have over the Indian casinos?" she asked.
"All casinos in Florida are run by the Indians, the Seminoles being by far the largest tribe and biggest operators. Frankly, though, and to be perfectly candid, when it comes to the Indian casinos, we have very little oversight and control. A tribe that has federal recognition is its own nation and makes its own laws. In Florida, we have entered into treaties with all casino operators, and this allows us to collect a small tax on their profits. Very small, but it adds up. There are now 9 casinos, and they are all doing quite well."
"Can you go into a casino and inspect its operations?" He shook his head gravely and admitted,
"No, nor can we check the books. Each casino files a quarterly report showing its gross revenues and net profits, and we tax from there. But frankly, we have to take their word for it."
"So a casino can submit whatever it wants?"
"Yes, that's the current state of the law, and it's not likely to change."
"And a casino pays no federal tax of any kind?"
"That's correct. By entering into treaties, we sort of cajole them into paying a little to the state. We do this by building a road here or there, and by providing a few services like emergency medical treatment and some educational support. On occasion, they'll ask for the state's help for this or for that, but truthfully, it's completely voluntary. If a tribe says no to any form of taxation, there's nothing we can do. Fortunately, none of them have taken that position."
"How much do they pay?"
0.5% of net. Last year, that was about $40 million. It funds the bulk of our commission, and the rest goes into the Florida Rainy Day Fund. May I ask where this is going?"
"Sure. A formal complaint has been filed alleging some bad behavior by a circuit court judge. It involves a developer who's apparently in bed with a tribe and its casino, and a judge who's sharing in the profits." Naylor set down his coffee cup and shook his head.
"Quite frankly, Ms. Stoltz, I'm not that surprised. If a casino wants to fudge on its financials and skim cash off the top or under the table, doesn't really matter. There's little to stop it from doing so. It's a perfect storm for corruption. You start with people who are not that sophisticated, and suddenly they're raking in more profits than are imaginable. They attract all manner of crooks and con men who want to help. Add the fact that most of the business is in cash that's absolutely untraceable, and it's just a bad mix. We here at the Commission are often frustrated by our lack of oversight.
So corruption does happen.
I didn't say it happens. I said the potential is there.
But nobody's watching. He recrossed his thick legs and thought about this.
Well, the FBI has the authority to investigate wrongdoing on Indian land, any kind of bad behavior. That's pretty intimidating, I suppose. And again, these folks are not that sophisticated, so the idea of the feds poking around keeps them in line. I should add that most of our casinos contract with reputable companies who know how to run casinos.
Could the FBI go in with warrants and grab the books?
I'm not sure. It's never been done, as far as I know. And over the past 20 years, the FBI has shown little interest in Indian affairs.
Why is that?
Don't know exactly, but I suspect it's a question of manpower. The FBI is focused on fighting terror and cybercrime. A bit of swindling in an Indian casino is of little interest. Why bother? The Indians have never had it so good, at least not in the past 200 years.
He dropped another cube of sugar into his coffee and stirred it with a finger.
This wouldn't be the Tapacola, would it?
It is.
I'm not that surprised.
And why not?
There have been rumors over the years.
He took a sip and waited for the follow-up. Okay. What kinds of rumors?
Outside influence. Some shady guys got involved from the beginning and are making a killing on developments around the casino. Just suspicions, that's all. Our job does not include investigating crimes, so we don't go near it. If we learn of wrongdoing, we're supposed to notify the FBI.
Rumors about skimming cash? He was shaking his head.
No, haven't heard that one.
Rumors about a judge? Still shaking, he said.
No, I'd be surprised if that were true.
It is surprising, but we have a source.
Well, there is a lot of cash, and it does strange things to people. I'd be very careful, Ms. Stoltz. Very careful.
You seem to know more than you're willing to tell.
Not at all.
Okay. But please remember that our investigations are confidential.
You have my word.
While Lacey was making her first and only call to the Florida Gaming Commission, her partner was making his first and only visit to a golf course. At the suggestion of Michael Geismar, and borrowing his seldom-used clubs, Hugo cajoled a BJC colleague named Justin Barrow into faking a round of golf. Justin had leaned on a friend who knew someone else, and after a fair amount of discreet manipulation and outright lying, a guest's tea time at Rabbit Run had been arranged. Justin was a weekend player. Thus, he knew the basic rules and enough etiquette not to arouse suspicions. Hugo had neither a clue nor a shred of interest. In the world he grew up in, golf was a white man's game played at white country clubs. The first tee box at Rabbit Run East was around the corner from the driving range and clubhouse, so no one noticed when Justin teed off, and Hugo did not. It was 10:30 on an August morning. The temperature was already above 90, and the course was deserted. Though Hugo, the driver of the golf cart, knew nothing about the game, he chose not to withhold his comments about Justin's lack of skill. When Justin failed on three consecutive sand shots to get the ball out of a green side bunker, Hugo was amused to the point of laughing out loud. On the third green, Hugo grabbed his borrowed putter and a ball and figured anybody could tap it into the cup. When it repeatedly failed to drop in from only 10 feet away, Justin unleashed an avalanche of trash talk. Using satellite photos, they had located the four condos allegedly owned, in one way or another, by Judge Claudia McDover. Geismar wanted site visits and photos. Standing at the fourth tee box, Hugo and Justin gazed at the long par five, dogleg left, and studied a row of handsome condos 250 yards away and out of bounds to the right. Hugo said,
"By now I know most of your shots go out of bounds, so try and place your tee shot over there by those condos. A hard slice, one of your specialties."
Justin replied,
"Why don't you take a shot, big guy, and see how easy it is?" "Game on."
Hugo stuck a tee in the grass, placed a ball on it, addressed the ball, tried to relax, and took a long, easy swing. The ball went a mile in the air and slowly began to hook left. The hook gained momentum, and by the time the ball disappeared into the woods, it was out of sight. Without a word, he yanked another ball out of his pocket, placed it on the tee, and with even more determination took a hack. The drive shot forward, low and hard, and slowly gained altitude. It appeared to be headed straight for the condos to the right, but soon rose high enough to sail over them. Justin said,
"Well, at least you're using the entire course. Those two shots are a mile apart and way out of bounds." "It's my first time out." "So I've heard."
Justin teed it up and looked at the fairway.
"I gotta be careful here because good contact could send the ball into the condos. Don't want to break any glass." "Just give it a ride and I'll spend some time looking for it."
The shot went just as planned. A hard slice that rolled out of bounds and into some shrubbery bordering the condos.
"Perfect," Hugo said. "Gee, thanks."
They hopped in the golf cart and sped down the middle of the fairway, then eased right toward the condos. Justin dropped a ball onto the grass as if it were his tee shot, and he pulled out a small device that appeared to be a laser range finder, one used to measure the distance from his ball to the flag. It was really a video camera. And while Hugo nonchalantly strolled over to the edge of the patio of Unit 1614D, as if hunting a lost ball, Justin shot close-up footage of the condo. Hugo had on his belt a small digital camera that snapped stills as he poked through some shrubs with his 7-iron. Just a couple of bad golfers hunting lost balls. Happened every day, whether someone was watching or not. 3 hours later, after searching for many lost balls, Hugo and Justin called it quits. As they drove away from the pro shop, Hugo silently vowed to never again set foot on a golf course. On the way back to Tallahassee, they detoured to the small town of Ekman for a quick chat with a lawyer named Al Bennett. He had a nice office on Main Street, and seemed to welcome Hugo to break the monotony of drafting deeds. Justin found a coffee shop to kill the hour. 5 years earlier, Bennett had entered politics for the first and last time when he challenged the re-election of Claudia McDover. He campaigned hard and spent too much money, and when only 31% of the voters favored him, he hustled back home to Ekman with a diminished desire to serve the public. On the phone, Hugo had revealed nothing and promised just a few quick questions about a local judge. In person, Hugo explained that the BJC was investigating a complaint against Judge McDover,
that the investigation was confidential, and that the complaint could well be frivolous. It was a sensitive matter, and Hugo needed Bennett's word that all would be kept quiet.
"Of course," Bennett said, eager to be involved and a little excited.
As they talked, Hugo wondered how the guy managed to get even 31% of the vote. He spoke rapidly, nervously, with a high-pitched voice that was obnoxious to the ears. Hugo could not imagine him on the stump or in front of a jury. Hugo was wary of the meeting. Lawyers could usually be trusted to keep secrets that involved their own clients, but were often horrible gossips when it came to everyone else. The more witnesses they interviewed, the more leaks there would be. And before long, Judge McDover and her confederates would know they were being shadowed. Lacey agreed, but Geismar wanted to put a check in Bennett's box. Hugo asked, "Was it a rough campaign?" Bennett replied,
"Well, you could say the outcome was rough. Hell, I got clobbered in a landslide. It hurt, but I'm almost over it."
"Was it dirty?" He thought for a moment and seemed to resist the temptation to trash his former opponent.
"It never got too personal. She made much of the fact that I have no experience on the bench. I couldn't argue with that, so I tried to take the high road and say, well, she didn't have any experience either until she got elected. But it took too long to explain this, and as you know, voters have short attention spans. Plus, Mr. Hatch, you got to keep in mind that Judge McDover has a good reputation."
"Did you attack her?"
"Not really. Couldn't find much."
"Did anyone allege ethical violations on her part?" He shook his head.
"No?"
Then he asked,
"What kinds of ethical violations are you investigating?"
Hugo made the quick decision to avoid anything of substance. If Bennett went through a tough campaign against McDover and heard no rumors of misconduct, Hugo was not about to reveal the allegations.
"You heard nothing?"
Hugo asked. Bennett shrugged as if he had nothing.
"Not really. A long time ago she had a bad divorce. She's still single, lives alone, no kids, no real community involvement. We weren't looking for dirt, and none came to the surface. Sorry."
"That's okay. Thanks for your time."
Leaving Ekman with another check in the box, Hugo was certain he had wasted an entire day in the pursuit of Claudia McDover. Lacey found the widow of Son Roscoe living in a small subdivision near Fort Walton Beach, about an hour from the Tapakola Reservation. Since she'd remarried, she was not technically a widow. Her name was Louise, and she was at first reluctant to talk. Halfway through the second phone call, she agreed to meet at a Waffle House and speak briefly. Since she had a job, she was not available until after work. Lacey drove 3 hours and met her at 6 p.m. on the same day that Hugo buzzed around Rabbit Run in a golf cart. According to the file and the records, Louise Roscoe had been 31 years old when her husband was found murdered and naked in the same bedroom with the wife of Junior Mace. She and Son had 2 children, now young adults, and both had left Florida. Louise had remarried a few years earlier and moved away from the reservation. She was pushing 50, with gray hair and a squat figure. The years were not being good to her. Lacey explained what she was up to, but Louise showed little interest.
"I am not going to talk about the murders and all that," she said initially.
"Fine. Off limits. Do you remember Judge McDover?" She sipped iced tea through a straw and gave the impression of wanting desperately to be somewhere else. Finally, she shrugged and said,
"Only from the trial."
"So you watched the trial?" Lacey asked, a throwaway. Anything to ramp up the conversation.
"Of course I watched the trial. All of it."
"What did you think of the judge?"
Why does it matter now? The trial was many years ago. Are you investigating the judge for something she did back then?
No, not at all. The complaint we are investigating centers on allegations that the judge is involved in a conspiracy to take bribes and such. It all revolves around the casino.
I prefer not to talk about the casino. It is a blight on my people.
Great, Louise. If we can't talk about the casino and we can't talk about your husband's murder, then why exactly did I drive all the way over here?
Lacey scribbled on a notepad, as if deep in thought. Have any of your family members ever worked in the casino?
Why do you ask?
Because we need information about the casino, and it's proving rather hard to find. Someone on the inside could be of great assistance.
You can forget that. No one will talk to you. The people who work there are happy to have jobs and to get the checks. The people who cannot work there are envious, maybe even bitter, but also content with their checks. No one is going to upset the casino.
Have you ever heard the name of Von Dubose?
No. Who is he?
What if I told you he is probably the man who killed your husband to get him out of the way so he could build a casino? Would you believe that? Lacey did in fact believe it. The problem was that she had so little proof. She made the rather bold suggestion in an effort to jolt Louise into a conversation. Louise took another sip and stared through a window. Lacey was learning a few things about the Tapacola. First, and not surprisingly, they did not trust outsiders. Couldn't blame them for that. Second, they were in no hurry when discussing matters. They were prone to slow, thoughtful speech, and long gaps in the conversation never seemed to bother them. Finally, Louise looked at Lacey and said,
"Junior Mace killed my husband. It was proven in court. I was humiliated."
As firmly as possible, Lacey said, "What if Junior did not kill your husband? What if he and Eileen Mace were killed by the same criminals who convinced the Tapacola to build the casino? The same people who've made a fortune from the developments around the casino? The same people who are in all likelihood skimming large amounts of cash from the business? And these same people are in business with Judge McDover. Does this shock you, Louise?"
Her eyes watered, and a tear spilled onto her right cheek.
"How do you know this?"
she asked. After having believed one version for so many years, it would be difficult to suddenly believe something else.
"Because we're investigators. That's what we do."
"But the crime was investigated by the police many years ago."
"It was a bogus trial that produced a wrongful conviction. The two star witnesses were both jailhouse snitches who were coerced by the cops and prosecutors to lie to the jury."
"I said I didn't want to talk about the murders."
"Right. So let's talk about the casino. I don't expect you to cooperate until you've thought about it carefully. But we need names of people, your people, who know what's happening. If you give us a name or two, no one will ever know. I promise. It's our job to protect the identity of our witnesses."
"I know nothing, Ms. Stoltz. I have never set foot in the casino. Never will. My family, too. Most of us have moved away. Sure, we take the checks because it's our land. But the casino has destroyed the soul of our people. I know nothing about it. I despise the place and the people who run it."
She was convincing, and Lacey knew the conversation was over. Another check in the box. Chapter 10. Michael Geismar paced along one wall of his office, tie loosened, sleeves rolled up, with the harried look of an investigator who'd bumped into too many dead ends. Lacey was holding a photo of one of McDover's condos and wondering how it could be of any value. Hugo, as usual, was sipping another caffeine-laced energy drink and trying to stay awake. Sadell was pecking on her laptop, chasing another elusive fact. Michael said,
"We got nothing. Four condos owned by offshore companies owned by somebody deep in the shadows, somebody we can't identify. When confronted, Judge McDover, through her legal team, no doubt, will simply deny ownership or claim she bought the condos as investments. Such investing might give the impression of impropriety, given her salary, but it's hardly a breach of judicial ethics. I don't have to remind you that she will lawyer up with enough legal talent to stall for the next decade. We need a lot more dirt."
Hugo said,
"I'm not playing any more golf. What a waste of time in more ways than one."
Michael replied,
"Okay, bad call on my part. You have any better ideas?"
Lacey said, "We're not giving up, Michael. We've uncovered enough to believe that Greg Myers is telling the truth, or at least something very close to it. We can't walk away."
"I'm not suggesting that. Not now.
In 3 weeks, we have to either serve the complaint on McDover or inform Greg Myers that our initial assessment leads us to believe that his complaint has no merit. I think we all agree that it has merit. So, we serve the complaint, then subpoenas for all of her files and records. At that point, she'll be hiding behind a wall of lawyers, so every request we make will be contested. Let's say we eventually get her files. Court files, legal files, files relating to the cases she has heard or is currently handling. We still subpoena her personal financial records unless we have probable cause to believe that she has committed theft, bribery, or embezzlement."
"We know the statute," Hugo said. "Of course we do, Hugo, but just humor me, okay? I'm trying to assess where we are, and since I'm the boss, I'm allowed to do so. You want to go back to the golf course?" "Please, no." Anyone sophisticated enough to operate behind such elaborate shell companies is probably not going to keep her personal financial records in any place where we might find them, right?
Lacey and Hugo nodded, pleasantly humoring the boss. And then there was silence. Michael kept pacing and scratching his head. Hugo sipped his caffeine and tried to activate his brain. Lacey doodled on her legal pad, thinking. The only sound was the pecking from Sadell's keyboard. Michael finally said,
"Sadell, you've been quiet."
"I'm just a paralegal," she reminded them.
Then she coughed, almost gagged, and continued.
"I've gone back 11 years and tracked 33 construction projects in Brunswick County. Everything from golf courses, shopping centers, subdivisions, the mini mall at Seastall, even a movie theater with 14 screens. Nylon Title from the Bahamas is involved in many of them. But there are dozens of other offshore companies that own other offshore companies, and LLCs that are owned by foreign corporations. Personally, I think it's a clear sign of somebody trying real hard to keep things secret. It smells bad. It's also unprecedented, really, to see so many offshore companies paying so much attention to a backward place like Brunswick County. I've dug some in the records of the other Panhandle counties. Okaloosa, Walton, even Escambia, where Pensacola sits. And while all of them have had far more development than Brunswick, they have far fewer offshore companies involved."
"No luck with Nylon Title?"
Hugo asked.
"None. The laws and procedures in the Bahamas are impossible to penetrate. Impossible, unless, of course, the FBI gets involved."
"That will have to wait." Michael looked at Lacey and asked,
"Have you talked to Myers lately?"
"Oh, no. I talk to Myers only when he decides he wants to talk."
"Well, it's time for a conversation. It's time to inform Mr. Myers that his complaint is in jeopardy. If he can't come through with more information, and quickly, then we might have to dismiss it."
"Are you serious?" Lacey asked.
Not really. Not yet. But let's keep the pressure on him. He's the one with the inside source.
It took 2 days and a dozen calls to 3 different cell phone numbers to get a response from Myers. When he finally called her back, he seemed excited to hear her voice and said he'd been thinking about another meeting. He had more information to pass along. Lacey asked if he might be able to meet at a more convenient place. St. Augustine was lovely and all, but it was a 3.5-hour drive for them. They had busy schedules. Evidently, he did not. For obvious reasons, he preferred to stay away from the panhandle.
"Lots of old enemies there,"
he sort of bragged. They agreed on Mexico Beach, a small gulfside town about 2 hours southeast of Tallahassee. They met at a local dive near the beach and ordered grilled shrimp for lunch. Myers rambled on about his bone fishing exploits near Belize and his scuba diving adventures in the British Virgins. His tan was even darker, and he looked a bit thinner. Not for the first time, Hugo caught himself envying the carefree lifestyle of this guy who lived on a nice boat and apparently had no financial worries. He drank beer from a cold, frosty mug. Something else Hugo envied. Lacey was far from envious, and found Myers even more irritating. She couldn't have cared less about his various adventures. She wanted facts, details, proof that his story was valid. With a mouthful of shrimp, Myers asked,
"So how is the investigation going?"
"Pretty slow," Lacey said. "Our boss is pressuring us to find more dirt, or we may have to dismiss your complaint. And the clock is ticking."
He stopped chomping, wiped his mouth with the back of his wrist, and removed his sunglasses. "You can't dismiss the complaint. I swore to it on my oath. McDover owns the 4 condos, and they were given to her as bribes."
Hugo asked,
"And how do we prove this when everything is buried offshore? We've hit brick walls there. All the records are tucked away in Barbados, Grand Cayman, Belize. Throw a dart at the offshore map and we've chased leads there, with no evidence. It's one thing to swear under oath she owns the companies that owns the condos, but we need proof, Greg."
He smiled, took a chug of beer, and said,
"I got it. Just wait."
Lacey and Hugo looked at each other. Greg stabbed another shrimp with his fork, drowned it in cocktail sauce, and shoved it in.
"You guys gonna eat?"
They poked around their shrimp baskets with their plastic forks, neither with much of an appetite. Evidently, Myers had not eaten in a while and was thirsty, but he was also stalling. An odd-looking couple had the table next to them, too close for a serious conversation. They left as the waitress brought Myers his second beer. "We're waiting," Lacey said.
"Okay, okay,"
he said as he took a sip and again wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"On the first Wednesday of every month, the judge leaves her office in Sterling an hour or so early and drives about 20 minutes to one of her condos in Rabbit Run. She parks her Lexus in the driveway, gets out, and walks to the front door. 2 weeks ago, she was wearing a navy sleeveless dress and pumps from Jimmy Choo. And she was carrying a small Chanel handbag, the same one she left the office with. She walked to the front door and unlocked it with her key. Proof of ownership. Exhibit 1. I have photographs. About an hour later, a Mercedes SUV parked next to the Lexus, and a guy got out on the front passenger's side. The driver stayed behind the wheel, never moved. The passenger walked to the front door. I have photographs, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, I think we finally have a glimpse of the elusive Von Dubose. He was carrying a brown leather satchel that appeared to be filled with something. As he pressed the doorbell, he glanced around and did not appear to be the least bit nervous. She let him in. He stayed 36 minutes,
and when he reappeared, he was carrying what looked like the same bag. Though, by the way he carried it, he might have left something behind. Can't really tell. He got in his vehicle and left. 15 minutes later, she did the same. This meeting takes place, as I said, on the first Wednesday of every month. And we are led to believe it is prearranged without the benefit of phones or email. Myers shoved his empty shrimp basket aside, took another swallow, and from his ever-present olive-colored leather courier bag removed two unmarked files. He glanced around and handed one file to Lacey and one to Hugo. All the photos were 8x10 and in color, and apparently taken from across the street. Number one was the rear of the Lexus, with the license plate clearly identifiable. Greg said, "Of course I checked the tags. Cars registered to our gal, Claudia McDover. Evidently one of the few assets in her name. Purchased new last year from a dealer in Pensacola." Number two was full length of Claudia, her face partially hidden behind large sunglasses. Lacey studied her 4-inch heels and asked, "How do you know who designed the shoes?"
"The mole knows," Myers said, and left it at that.
Number three was Claudia with her back to the camera as she opened the front door, presumably with a key, though one was not visible. Number four was the black Mercedes SUV parked beside the Lexus, its license plate also clearly visible. Myers said,
"It's registered to a man whose address is a high-rise condo near Destin, and not surprisingly, his name is not Von DuBose. We're still digging. Take a look at number five."
Number five was the man himself. A nice-looking, well-tanned Florida retiree in a golf shirt and golf slacks, thin and balding with a gold watch on his left wrist. Myers said,
"To my knowledge, and I have no idea what's in the FBI files, but I suspect they have nothing. This is the only photo of Von DuBose."
"Who took it?" Lacey asked.
"Guy with a camera. It's also on video. Let's just say the mole is resourceful."
"Not good enough, Greg," Lacey shot back with a flash of anger. "It's obvious someone is watching McDover's movements. Who is it? You're still playing cat and mouse, and I'd like to know why."
Hugo said, "Look, Greg, we need to trust you, but we have to know what you know. Someone is following McDover. Who the hell is it?"
Out of habit, and an irritating one, Myers glanced around again, saw things were still clear, removed his aviator shades, and said in a low voice,
"I get my information from the middleman, still unnamed as far as you're concerned. He deals with the mole, whose name I still don't know, and I'm still not sure I want to know. When the mole has something important to pass along, the middleman tracks me down, hands it over, I give it to you. I'm sorry if you don't like this arrangement, but please keep in mind that the mole and the middleman and me and you and everyone involved in this little story could easily wake up dead one day with a bullet between the eyes. I don't care if you trust me or not. My job is to pass along enough information to help you nail Judge Claudia McDover. What else do you need?"
A quick sip from his sweaty mug and,
"Now, please return to photo number five. We don't know if this guy is Von DuBose, but let's assume he is. Check out his bag. Brown leather, large, more of a satchel than a briefcase, well-worn, or maybe just the distressed look that's currently popular, and not small. This is no thin attaché containing a couple of files. No, this bag is being used to carry something."
"What?"
"Well, our guy speculates that McDover and DuBose meet on the first Wednesday of each month for an exchange. Why would DuBose, who's dressed like a golfer, need a rather significant bag this late in the day? He's obviously delivering something." "Check out photo number six.
It was taken 36 minutes after number 5. Same guy, same bag. If you study the video, you can argue that the bag possibly weighs less just by the way he moves with it. Frankly, I can't tell.
So he takes her the cash once a month, Lacey said.
He takes something to the condo.
How recent are these photos?
Hugo asked.
12 days ago, August 3rd.
But there's no way to verify if this is really von Dubose, Lacey asked.
Not to my knowledge. Again, Dubose has never been arrested. He has no criminal record, no identity. He uses only cash for living expenses. He hides behind underlings and associates and leaves no trail. We've done some digging, and I'm sure you have too, and there's no driver's license, social security number, or passport issued to a von Dubose anywhere in this country. He has a driver, as we can see. He could be living as Joe Blow, for all we know, with perfect papers.
Myers reached into his trick bag and pulled out 2 more files. He handed one to Hugo and one to Lacey, who asked, "What's this?"
A detailed summary of McDover's travel over the past 7 years. Dates, places, chartered jets, and so on. She almost always goes with her buddy, Phyllis Turbin, who hires the jets and pays the bills. Turbin also books the rooms when they use hotels. She handles all the details. Nothing, so far, is in McDover's name.
"And why is this valuable?" Lacey asked.
By itself, it's not that useful. But it does lend credence to the theory that these high-flying gals spent a shit pot full of money jetting around the country, presumably buying valuable things with dirty cash. Their combined earnings would not cover the cost of the jet fuel. We know the judge's salary. I can guess what Turbin nets, and I'll bet it's less than McDover's take-home. There might come a time when it's necessary to build a case based on net worth and consumption and assets. So I'm gathering all the dirt I can find.
Hugo said,
"Please keep digging. We need plenty of help."
"You're not serious about dismissing my complaint. I mean, hell, look at the photos. How can you argue she doesn't own this condo when she's been going there for at least 7 years and she has the key? It's registered to a shell in Belize, and it's worth, on today's market, at least $1 million.
Does she ever spend the night there, or entertain? Lacey asked.
Don't think so. I checked it out last week, Hugo said. Played golf and took photos from the fairway.
Myers shot him a quizzical look.
What did you learn?
Absolutely nothing. A complete waste of time. Like most rounds of golf.
Try bone fishing. It's much more fun.
As Lacey was painting her toenails near the end of a Cary Grant movie, her phone buzzed with an unknown caller. A voice told her it might be Myers, and the voice was right.
"Breaking news," he said. "Tomorrow is Friday."
"How'd you guess?"
"Hang on. Looks like the girls are headed to New York. Claudia will catch a jet at the airport at Panama City around noon. Exact time doesn't matter because when you lease a jet, you leave when you want. Lear 60, tail number N38WW. Owned and operated by a charter company based in Mobile. Presumably, her lawyer pal will be on board. And they're off to New York for fun and games. Probably with a sack full of cash to do some serious shopping. In case you don't know, there is virtually no security with private jet travel. No scanners for bags or body searches. I guess the smart guys at Homeland Security figure rich people have little interest in blowing up their own jets en route. Anyway, you could literally pack 100 pounds of pure heroin and fly anywhere domestically."
"Interesting. But where's the payoff?"
"If I were you, and if I had nothing better to do, I'd be hanging around the General Aviation Terminal. It's called Gulf Aviation,
and have a look. I'd keep Hugo in the car because you don't see too many black folks in the charter business, so he might stand out. I'd also keep him in the car with a camera to take a few photos. Maybe Phyllis will get off the plane for a pit stop in the girls' room. Who knows? You might learn a lot, and you can certainly see who you're dealing with.
Would I be conspicuous?
Lacey, dear, you're always conspicuous. You're too pretty not to be. Wear some jeans, pull your hair back, try different glasses. You'll be okay. There's a lounge area with magazines and newspapers, and people sit there all the time. If anybody asks, just say you're waiting on a passenger. The place is open to the public, so you won't be trespassing. I'd take a good look at Claudia. See what she's wearing, but also what she's taking with her. I wouldn't expect to see pockets stuffed with cash, but there might be an extra bag or two. Sort of a lark, but not a bad way to spend some time. Personally, I'd like the chance to bump into a Florida gal who just happens to be the most corrupt judge in the history of America, and one who will soon be all over the front page, though she hasn't a clue. Go for it.
We'll give it a try. Chapter 11. Judge McDover parked close to the space where Hugo sat rather awkwardly in Lacey's Prius, his face hidden behind a newspaper, his camera by his side. To go with his collection of thoroughly useless photos of the East Nine at Rabbit Run, he could now add a few shots of a Lear 60 out there on the tarmac. As Claudia rolled her small suitcase across the parking lot and headed for the front door of Gulf Aviation, he snapped a few of her backside. At 56, she was slender, and at least from the rear could pass for a lady 20 years younger. Actually, he had to admit, from this angle she looked better than Verna, who, after child number 4, was struggling to drop the weight. He simply couldn't stop the habit of staring at the backsides of all nicely shaped females. After she disappeared inside, Hugo put away his camera and his newspaper and fell asleep. After years in crime, Claudia McDover had gradually learned how to think like a suspect. She noticed everything, from the black guy sitting in the passenger seat of the small Toyota reading a newspaper, which seemed a bit odd at noon, to the cute redhead who worked the front desk and gave her a big smile, to the harried business guy in the dark suit whose flight was obviously late, to the pretty girl on the sofa flipping through a copy of Vanity Fair. She seemed a bit out of place. In a matter of seconds, Claudia sized up the lobby, deemed it safe and clear, and filed away all the faces. In her world, every phone could be tapped, every stranger could be watching, every letter could be violated, every email could be hacked. But she wasn't paranoid and did not live in fear. She was only cautious. And after years of practice, her caution was second nature. A young man in a crisp uniform stepped forward, introduced himself as one of the pilots, and took her suitcase. The cute redhead hit a button, the doors slid open, and Claudia left the terminal. Such exits, though short on drama and unwitnessed by the world, still gave her a thrill. While the masses queued up in endless lines and waited for flights that were crowded, delayed, or canceled, and finally, if lucky, were then herded like cattle onto dirty airplanes packed with seats far too narrow for modern American rumps, she, Judge Claudia McDover of Florida's 24th Judicial District, strolled like a queen to her private jet, where the champagne was on ice and the flight would be on time and non-stop. Phyllis was waiting. Once the pilots were strapped in and busy with their routines, Claudia gave her a kiss and held her hand. After takeoff, and once the jet leveled off at 38,000 feet, Phyllis popped the cork on a bottle of Veuve Clicquot, and they toasted, as always, the Tapacola tribe. They had met during their second year of law school at Stetson, and the similarities had been remarkable. Both were reeling from terrible first marriages. Both had chosen law school for the wrong reasons. Claudia had been wiped out and humiliated by her husband and his nasty lawyers and was plotting revenge. Phyllis's divorce decree required her ex to cover the cost of her continued education. She chose med school to drag things out as long as possible, but bombed the MCAT. She turned to law school and clipped him for 3 more years of postgraduate study. She and Claudia began dating on the sly during their 3rd year, then went their separate ways after graduation. They were women in a weak job market and grabbed what they could find. Claudia went to a small firm in a small town. Phyllis worked as a public defender in Mobile until she got tired of street criminals and found refuge in an office practice. Now that the Indians had made them rich, they traveled in style, lived in understated luxury, and were plotting their final getaway to a place yet to be determined. When the champagne was gone, both fell asleep. For 17 years, Claudia had worked diligently at her job, because she was, after all, always up for re-election. Phyllis, too, put in long hours in her busy little firm. They never had enough sleep. 2.5 hours after leaving Florida, the jet touched down at Teterboro, New Jersey, home to more private aircraft than any other airport in the world. A black town car was waiting and whisked them away. 20 minutes later, they arrived at their building in Hoboken, a sleek new high-rise on the Hudson, directly across the river from the financial district. From their perch on the 14th floor, they had a spectacular view of downtown Manhattan. Lady Liberty was only a stone's throw away. The apartment was spacious and sparsely decorated. It was an investment, not a home, just a place to keep until they chose to flip it. It was, of course, owned by an offshore shell entity, this one domiciled in the Canary Islands. Phyllis took great delight in playing the international shell game and was constantly moving money and companies around to find the hottest new tax haven. With time and experience, she had become an expert at hiding their money. After dark, they put on jeans and took a car into the city, to Soho, where they dined at a tiny French bistro. Later, in a dimly lit bar, they sipped more champagne and giggled at how far they'd traveled. Not just in distance, but in life. The Armenian's name was Papazian, and they'd never known whether it was his first or last name. Not that it mattered. Their dealings were shrouded in secrecy. Neither side asked questions because no one wanted answers. He rang their doorbell at 10 Saturday morning, and after the required pleasantries, opened his briefcase. On a small breakfast table, he spread his dark blue felt and arranged his goodies. Diamonds, rubies, and sapphires. As always, Phyllis served him a double espresso, which he sipped as he described each gem. After 4 years of doing business, they knew Papazian dealt in only the finest stones. He had a shop in Midtown, where they had first met him, but now he was quite happy to make a house call. He had no clue who they were or where they came from. His only concern was the transaction and the cash. In less than 30 minutes, they selected a fistful of his best. Portable wealth, as Phyllis liked to say, and handed over the money. He slowly counted $230,000 in $100 bills, mumbling all the while in his native tongue. When everyone was happy, he gulped down the last of his espresso, his second, and left their apartment. With the bulk of the dirty work out of the way, the girls got dressed and took a car into the city. They bought shoes at Barney's, had a long lunch at Le Bernardin, and eventually drifted to the Diamond District, where they dropped in on one of their favorite dealers. With cash, they bought a selection of new, uncirculated gold coins, Krugerrands from South Africa, maple leafs from Canada, and, to help the local economy, American Eagles. All cash, no paperwork, no records, no trail. The tiny shop had at least 4 surveillance cameras, and these had once been a concern. Someone, somewhere, might be watching. But those concerns had been set aside. In their business, there were always risks. The trick was choosing which ones to accept. Saturday night, they watched a musical on Broadway, dined afterward at Orso, but saw no celebrities, and went to bed after midnight, content with another successful day of laundering. Late Sunday morning, they packed their loot, along with their handsome collection of new and horribly expensive shoes, and took a car back to Teterboro, where the jet was waiting for the return trip south. Chapter 12. Hugo was late for the meeting, and while they waited, Geismar reviewed the new photos and the travel records as Lacey returned emails.
"Any idea why these go back only 7 years?"
he asked. "None. Myers doesn't know, but speculates that the mole arrived on the scene at about that time. Obviously, the mole is someone close to McDover, and perhaps that's when he or she got involved."
"Well, he or she is certainly spending some money. It's hard to believe these photos could have been taken by someone sitting in a car on the street. It's more likely that the photographer was inside one of the condos."
"There are 4 of them in a unit directly across the street," Lacey said. 2 are available for rent at $1,000 a week. We are assuming he or she rented one, set up the camera, and knew precisely when McDover and DuBose would arrive. That's some pretty serious intel."
"Indeed it is. Myers knows what he's talking about, Lacey. These guys are doing some dirty business. Not sure we can prove it, but the evidence is looking stronger. What will McDover say when confronted with all this?"
"I guess we'll find out soon enough." The door swung open and Hugo appeared. He said,
"Sorry I'm late. Another rough night."
He tossed his briefcase on the table and took a sip from a tall coffee.
"I would have been here sooner, but I've been on the phone with a guy who won't give me his name."
Geismar nodded, waiting, still holding one of the photos. Lacey said, "Okay."
"He called first around 5 this morning. A bit early, but I just happened to be awake. Said he worked at the casino and had some information that might be useful. Said he knew we were investigating the tribe and the judge and he could help. I pressed a little, and he hung up. About an hour ago, he called again from a different number and said he wanted to meet and talk about a deal. I asked what kind of deal, and he got pretty vague. He said there was a lot of shady stuff going on, and it was just a matter of time before it blew up. He's a member of the tribe. Knows the chief and the folks who run the casino, and doesn't want to get caught in the storm when it all hits the fan."
Hugo was pacing around the room, as was his habit of late. Sitting made him sleepy. Lacey said, "This could be interesting." Geismar fell into his swivel and locked his hands behind his head.
"Nothing else?" "No, but he wants to meet tonight. Said he works a late shift and is not free until after 9 p.m. "You think he's for real?"
Geismar asked.
"Who knows? He certainly sounded nervous, and he used 2 different phones, probably disposable. He repeatedly asked me about secrecy and wanted to know how we can protect his identity. He said a lot of his people are fed up with the corruption but afraid to talk."
"Where does he want to meet?" Lacey asked.
"He lives not far from the casino, on the reservation. He said he'll find a spot and call us when we get close." "We gotta be careful here,"
Geismar said.
This could be a setup. I don't think so, Hugo said. I got the impression I was talking to a guy who needs help and wants to help.
Which cell phone are you using?